Before we get started with today's show, I want to tell you about another great ESPN podcast, Brian Windhorst and the Hoop Collective. They post episodes on Tuesday and Friday mornings, bright and early. The NBA playoffs are here, so be sure to check it out. You can follow Brian Windhorst and the Hoop Collective as well as The Right Time wherever you get your podcasts. Also, ESPN Plus gives you live daily coverage of the PGA Championship from the Ocean Course at Kiawah Island this weekend from May 20th through the 23rd. Stream the exclusive main feed each morning, featured groups every day, and more. Sign up at ESPNplus.com/golf. The Right Time with Bomani Jones is brought to you by Goodyear, helping you discover the road ahead. Goodyear, more driven. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. It is the time of week we have a guest join us, coming to us live. He is the best college football writer in America, but we ain't really going to talk about none of that. Spencer Hall, what's going on, man?
Stevie Wonder. What's going on. I just want to get straight to the point. You might be here to talk about college football. And if you happen to bust in this room right now and ask me a question, I will address it. But unless you're an intruder, we're just going to talk about Stevie today. Maybe a little Kwame Brown.
But as I was about to say, yeah, we'll make a quick, slow transition into Stevie by stopping at the midpoint between Stevie and college football, which is South Georgia. I feel like everybody learned this week something they may not have known, which is how South Georgia gets down, how Glencoe gets down. Glencoe, not here for it. Like, Kwame Brown's one of these dudes we met when he was 19, and we didn't think much about it after that, and then we looked up and was like, damn, you're an old man now.
You're an old man. You sound like it. You can tell, by the way, Kwame Brown has an uncle or an elder, somebody that he has absolutely patterned this particular speech pattern after, because I heard it, and I was like, oh, I know that guy. That man does not really care about your opinions. He starts conversations by asking about your opinion, but he does not really care about your opinion. He'd go, hey, what do you think about Joe Biden? And you go, well, you know, here's what I think. He's like, here's what I think. And then it just goes. All right.
Yes.
He knew that guy. And Kwame Brown has basically subsumed his entire identity. And if you think, by the way, that South Georgia cares at all about anywhere else or anything or about how anything goes in the rest of the world, then you're wrong. It's one of those little pockets, right? Kind of like I've always talked about South Alabama Vikings, right? Like, yes. South Alabama is its own little universe. South Georgia is its own tiny little universe where people will make great distinctions between, well, where are you from? Well, you know, I'm from Vidalia. And they'll be like, no. like that's a judgment, right? Like, that means something different than being, you know, from Savannah or being from Valdosta, right? There's very fine gradations of things. And Kwame Brown, I can tell just from this video, just from the hour that I watched, which, yes, yesterday I did spend an entire hour watching Kwame Brown go off on all of his haters and indulge only the thickest of South Georgia and basically Southern accents. I watched the whole thing yesterday.
Well, my thing was, all he gave was the ether to make your soul burn slow, right? Like it was all, like, I always thought Takeover was better than Ether. But the thing about Ether versus Takeover was, Takeover was for everybody. Ether was for one man. And the Jay-Z in this scenario for Kwame Brown is clearly Matt Barnes. Like, he's got some problems with Steven Jackson. He's got some problems with Stephen A. Smith. But Matt Barnes, that's the one where he's like, I am twisting this knife over and over again.
Yeah. And by the way, another important part of the ether or the diss track here is that it's not fair, and we don't necessarily personally condone or endorse any of it. You're just there to listen to the sheer hatred. You're not there to say, hey, Kwame, this isn't unproblematic. No, on the contrary, a lot of it is very problematic. Okay.
Yes.
But is it intense? Is it sustained? And is it deeply felt? 100%. Could you go ahead and go through it and say, I don't feel this way about this at all. I'm actually kind of offended by this. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm not sitting here and saying any of it's good or condoning any of it. I'm marveling at the intensity and the sustained aggression of it, because I'm pretty sure he could have talked about how much he hated Matt Barnes for 3 hours.
Yes. Yeah. And I think that people need to understand is, this is a dude who had an abusive relationship with his father, as I understand it, and then went into the NBA, where he walked into an abusive relationship with Michael Jordan. And it seems very clear to me that Kwame has been like, I may have had to take this from my pops. I may have had to take this from Michael Jordan. Hard stop. That's it. Not from you.
Not from Matt Barnes. No. Can I say, by the way, that given everything that he has been through, both from his upbringing, abusive relationship to his father, towards a professional mentorship, and I'm using that word real ironically, from Michael Jordan, I think Kwame Brown is actually displaying a pretty high level of evolved mental health. There is something iron in this man that cannot be broken, because all Kwame Brown was in the NBA for the better part of a decade was a joke. And when you say that, Kwame Brown will respond, and I am quoting here, "I put my mama on a golf course at 18. That's exactly how Kwame Brown will come back. He'll be like, "You think I'm a joke? That's cool. Talk to the bank account." Because he does make, like, you go through the video and I'm sitting there saying, like, "Hey, I don't condone any of this." Man's got points. Man does have points in the middle of all this. Like, for instance, when he says, "Ain't no man in the NBA a failure. Ain't no man a bust." That's true.
There's something to it.
You know, you made it to the NBA. Now, you might have been a number one pick and your value might have, potential might have been dramatically overestimated, right? But one, as Kwame Brown will say, "I went to the Wizards." Man has points, right? And then he'll say, even with that, my favorite part in terms of scale, this is where you go, yeah, the NBA just completely distorts your understanding of what wealth is. When he says, "Yeah, Gilbert Arenas, you're like the worst human being ever born. You know, I was set to make $80 million and you took money out of my mouth," right? When he says that, he's like, "Yeah, and then I had to sign for the Lakers for just $27 million. That was the disappointment, which I'll admit, if I'm already over there and that's my scale and I'm a 6'11 guy who can block shots and dunk, I'll be bitter about that. From my perspective, I'm not exactly seeing the huge tragedy there. You still got 27 mil.
Yeah, he finished with 63 for his career. My favorite part about "I put my mom on a golf course at 18 was that he was 19 when he got drafted. The money had already begun to flow.
Well, I like that too, because either one, the money had already begun to flow, right? Or he's wrong and he's just forgetting it, which is even funnier, right? That he's just, you know, like, just let him go. He's on one. Let him roll.
Did you know you went to high school with Adam Wainwright?
No, I did not know that.
We had Adam Wainwright. I don't know who he pitched for now, but he's pitched for the Cardinals. And we had him on Highly Questionable, and I didn't know anything about him. And so I Googled him, and I was like, "Oh, he's from Brunswick." And I looked at his age, and I was like, "Huh, I wonder if he knows Kwame Brown." I was like, "Did you go to school with Kwame Brown?" He's like, "Oh, yeah, I know Kwame." Like, he seemed to like Kwame Brown a lot.
And evidently, Kwame Brown, very different than anybody really expected. He opens the video by discussing a brawl he gets into, using words I can't use on any podcaster in real life, but getting into a fight with a gigantic football player and then knocking that football player out. And in a moment of real self-awareness saying, "My friend said I looked goofy punching him out." And he goes, "Yeah, but he still went to sleep, even with these ugly punches.
I jumped on his head like a trampoline," I believe was the is the way that he described this fight with this. The other thing that people got a glimpse of was critical race theory, country style. Like, he has some very clear views on race that are very much colored by living under Deep South racism. Me and Matt Barnes, which one hated you? Your granddaddy that was black or your granddaddy that was white? And I heard that and I'm like, which one? Like that? I'm kind of curious which one, because chances are it's one of them.
Yeah. And in addition to that, by the way, it's also colored by a very Southern understanding of when things are on or off, i.e. that you're going to be out of pocket once things get out of pocket. There's no, "Hey, that's enough. Let's go ahead and stop pursuing this fight." No. If you get into the story, which is like the first 10 minutes, if you just go get the main Kwame Brown responds video, which is like an hour long, just listen to the brawl in the first part, because he breaks his hand on this gigantic football player's face, knocks him out, runs. And when he's running, he ends up somehow at like a barbecue or a party. And when he gets to the party, the immediate response isn't, "Oh my, what is this strange person who is 6'11, by the way?" Like, Kwame Brown stumbling into your party is not a small event. It's this massive dude with his friends, right, rolling in. And immediately is administered first aid. That's what it sounds like. Like, he's like, yeah, these ladies were like, oh, poor thing. Meaning they, in an instant, when this 6'11 dude just comes crashing in like a giraffe into their party, are like, he requires assistance. He's obviously been in a fight, right? Like, there's this entire 911 system that happens instantly. Like, wrap up his hand, get him set. Let's go get him an Uber. Let's get him a taxi, get him out of here before the cops come. The number of decisions that goes into that moment where questions would have been asked somewhere else, right? Like, let's just say if this happens in, you know, quiet suburban Chicago, right? We'll be like, what is this man doing here? Who are you? What's going on? Perhaps we should get the authorities involved. Nope. Kwame stumbles into this party somewhere in South Georgia, and they're like, oh, yeah, no, we got this. We got this. Get him a taxi, wrap him up. Sure, the brawls happen. We're good. Like, that is an entirely different way of living that's all assumed and understood in, like, 3 seconds.
Well, the underrated part of this also, to me, is Gilbert Arenas, right? Because what has become clear, okay, Gilbert Arenas, Mr. Go Too Far, right? Like, his whole steez is go too far. Did you see where he got on, he did a podcast with Levitard, where he talked about how, I forget what he did to some suit that Chris Mills had, like he had done something to desecrate this dude's clothes or whatever. And he said that Chris Mills didn't say a word about it, right? Like, it happened, didn't say nothing. And he said that Chris Mills was his ride home. So Chris Mills is driving the car, drove Gilbert Arenas home. Gilbert Arenas gets out the car, and then next thing he knows, Chris Mills hits him with the car. Like, he waited it all the way out, played it all the way cool, and then Chris Mills hit him with the car, okay? This is also the Gilbert Arenas who, in the infamous situation with Javaris Crittenden and the guns in the locker room and everything else, was 100% unafraid, right? Like, because basically he gets, now granted, Crittenden wound up going farther in his life into these realms, but he was just basically like, I can smell it on him and he ain't gonna do nothing. Like, that's who Gilbert Arenas is. Guess who Gilbert Arenas does not feel that way about? Kwame Brown. Gilbert Arenas has been on Instagram everywhere like, nope, I'm not saying a word about this guy. I have seen his movies.
No, and by the way, this is somebody who in DC, according to Kwame Brown, got lit up daily by guys just for being extra, just for being Gilbert Arenas. And just because, as Kwame Brown said, there's a lot of country dudes in DC who won't take that, who have hands, right? Try these hands. They're faster than you think. And that means that of all of the guys who went around just willy-nilly slapping Gilbert Arenas for being Gilbert Arenas. And by the way, shouts out to Gilbert Arenas for never learning a lesson. What is Gilbert Arenas' superpower? I'm never going to learn the lesson that I'm me, right? Like, dude who does not have any self-understanding whatsoever. Like, why do these people keep hitting me with a car? Why do I keep getting in fights where I have to pull a gun over cards? Why do I keep getting slapped by random guys in DC? At no point has it dawned on Gilbert Arenas that he's Gilbert Arenas. And yet, even with that superpower of not knowing who he is, he won't mess with Kwame Brown. Which, I have to say, like, Kwame Brown already seems like he's 6'11". If 6'11 winds up and slaps you, that is a lot of implied force, right?
Yes.
Like, the arm, the lever, that is a tremendous slap. I don't want any of that. And by the way, he is the kind of dude who will slap you first.
Dude, you want to stay up all night smoking weed and playing cards. That, you want to smoke weed and play cards all night. That is such an old man thing to say. I don't even know if these dudes play cards, right? But it also became very clear, Kwame Brown is not 420 friendly. Kwame Brown does not see any charm in y'all smoking weed and playing cards all night. Put the blunt down.
No, Kwame Brown sounds like the kind of guy who's like, I got an engine to put in a truck at 7 a.m. I got to get up and do that before I go fishing. So you need to go ahead and get this mess on. Get yourself to bed. That's Kwame Brown. Kwame Brown's 38 going on 68.
Yes.
Right? And whether you agree or disagree with anything he said, you have to absolutely respect the fact that the man hit, I'm guessing, 23 and just decided, nope, I'm 53. Just went right into it, right? Everybody has different ages, right? Some people stay 14 until they're 44, then they turn about 48, and then they turn 68 and they become 80, right? Like, everybody's got different ages. I think Kwame Brown had two. I think he was probably 4 years old, and then he went to being like 58.
The worst thing to happen to Kwame's career, I think, is he wound up playing for the Lakers, right? And I was thinking to myself, well, where in the world will Kwame Brown hang out in L.A.? He's playing for the Lakers, right? Like, where would he hang out? But L.A., y'all got to realize, all them folks came from the country too, right? Like, maybe a generation away or whatever, but it's some L.A. spots. Kwame needed to go to Oakland. Like, he played 9 games for the Warriors, I saw. He didn't have, like, a real run with the Warriors. But Oakland, where they actually have places where you can go to smoke weed and play cards all night, maybe he would not have wanted to be there, but still, it's according to a paradigm that is familiar to Kwame Brown. He could have become beloved. We got a word on the street that Kwame Brown was walking around Oakland slapping people in the face. We didn't look at him completely differently.
No, and he also, like, when you talk about, you know, places where I think he, you know, LA, I cannot see him being anything but supremely isolated. I do not see him understanding, you know, like, there may be parts of LA where I think Kwame would be, like, super comfy, but just overall, the Lakers in particular, no. Glitz and glamour does not define that man.
No. There's places where he'd be comfortable. It's just places he shouldn't be.
I could also see, by the way, that if we could just shift time around a little bit and get him on, like, a Grizzlies team, that's it.
Oh, yeah.
If I can get him within the loving embrace of Zach Randolph and Gasol, oh, that's all I want.
But that's the thing. He was only in Memphis briefly because he was in the Pau Gasol trade. Like, the two places he should have been were Memphis and Oakland, and he only got a cup of coffee there. And it's maybe because they looked around like, yo, we got to get this dude out of here, man. He fit in too well.
Can I also say this, that Kwame, in terms of citing people up, if I were just to give you a grab bag, I'm like, you got to go online, Bo, and for an hour, I need you to go ahead and just tell of your disgust for 3 people in the NBA. 3, okay? In the last 20 years. And if I told you to pick a fantasy league of people you would not want the smoke from, okay? You would not want any part of, okay? I don't think it's the definitive list, but if you told me Steve Jackson, Matt Barnes, and Gilbert Arenas, I would have told you you were a madman, right? Like, if you told me 3 guys in the NBA who you know, I was just going to go and talk absolute mess about, those are not the 3 I would pick.
Right.
That's a pretty stout list. The difficulty level is there. Even if you don't think Matt Barnes can fight, he'll get there. He will show up. There is a demonstrated record of this happening. Even if you don't think Gilbert Arenas is all about it, right? If you think that Gilbert Arenas isn't really going to follow through on all this, he still might show up with a gun. Once Stupid shows up with a gun, anything can happen, right? And I think if you show up with a gun to a fight over some social media stuff, that's pretty stupid. And then if I, on top of that, you pick Steven Jackson, a demonstrated track record of being about it. Right? Of having hands. And when I say having hands, I meant on national TV.
Yes.
Against civilians.
And he went there.
No, he did that. This would not be the 3 I picked. Kwame went hard.
No, and on the other side, if you had asked me to come up with my mock draft of players of the last 20 years with whom you do not want the smoke, Kwame would not have been there. But this week is basically, I went to Indy and ran a 4.15 40. And suddenly I'm the number 1 receiver in the draft.
No, check the record. That's it. The combine. This was Kwame's hands combine. Evidently, he passed with flying colors.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Round. Oh, yeah. Did a great job in the interviews. All of it, man. Like, he came out of there like the prospect. And now this leads to the question. What do you think is Kwame Brown's favorite Stevie Wonder song? Because after seeing his old man country vibe and all of that, I feel like he is right at that superstition level, right? Like, as soon as he hears that, da, 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 he's like, oh, boy, that's my song.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I could also see, by the way, Kwame having a special moment in his heart for Ribbon in the Sky. I think that maybe he's the kind of, he's like, that's what love is about.
Yes.
Right? That's real love. That's some slow dancing with your lady thing there.
Yes.
Right there.
Yes.
I could see Kwame having a real Ribbon in the Sky thing, right? And then somebody make fun of him about it. And he'd be like, don't make me slap you.
Yeah. Like, nobody's like, hey, man, you know, normally I listen to a lot of Johnny Taylor, but today I decided I wanted to go back to that Stevie. Everybody loves Stevie, right? And see, that is the thing about Stevie Wonder. Because somehow Stevie Wonder's birthday was last week, and somebody got on the internet and said, I'd love to hear Spencer Beaumonte talk about Stevie Wonder. We're like, oh, done. That's all we needed. The people said we're going to talk about Stevie Wonder. Okay, cool. We can talk about Stevie Wonder. And you and I independently have just been listening to Stevie Wonder all week long.
Oh, everything. Yeah, no. From like fingertips to in squared circle. I listened to a little bit of the Babyface song. I did. It happened.
Yes.
Okay. I can't really, when you say Stevie, I just go, okay, listen, did your professional career start at 11 because you were scouted? That's how Stevie was discovered. Remember, this is a person so talented that as an 11-year-old, when his mom said, oh, hey, you should listen to my baby song, a member of the Miracles goes, okay, yeah, let him play. And then heard him sing and heard one song and was like, we're getting you to the studio today. You're going to meet Barry Gordy and we're going to sign you and you're going to be developmental for us immediately at the age of 11. When I tell you this man's prime creative career, when people are like, oh, this seasoned veteran cranking out music channeled directly from God himself. How old was he? 25. He was 25 and 26 years old and had been working as a professional musician for the better part of a decade and a half before he hit his absolute stride, and he was 25, 26 years old.
So, like, let's consider the fact that Uptight, which is like an all-time record, right? In large part because of the bass, but still is an all-time record, and he wrote it, and he was 15 years old. 15 years old. Because, like, to me, like, Fingertips is cool and it's a novelty, right? Uptight is like, oh, so this is where this is going, huh?
That's the thing. Like, at every point in Stevie's career, by the way, this happens. He's a child wonder when he does Fingertips. So, okay, so he's a child novelty act. He's like Wayne Newton. Improbably young and improbably talented, and we can probably shuffle him off to Vegas. No, he does Uptight. And keep in mind, Uptight, by the way, is produced, and it is co-written, and it is played with a bunch of adults.
Yes.
Seasoned adults who have this 15-year-old and who are like, take it. Here, this is yours. That's the lead. Think about that. Every talented musician in Motown wanted to work with Stevie Wonder and happily fronted him, put him forward, okay? Put a blind 15-year-old kid out front, not because he was just a novelty, but because he was the truth. That is insane when you consider the level and the degree of talent in that building.
Dude, you and I were talking about this, and I think an underrated thing about the Stevie catalog, because everybody wants to act like, oh, I love a quote-unquote real artist, right? Like, people love to big themselves up in that regard. And so it's interesting, with Motown, we big up all the Motown stuff from the assembly line era, but we have a tendency to try to minimize the Stevie stuff from that era, because it's like, no, we got to do it all by himself. Yeah, okay, cool. Except, like, the last two or three of those Motown assembly line albums are incredible, and he did them when he was 18. Like, for once in my life, that is kind of sort of album era, but not really album era. You know what all was on that damn album? For Once in My Life, Shooby Dooby Doo Dah Day, You Met Your Match, I Don't Know Why I Love You, and I Don't Need to Tell You Anything Else. 18 years old, right? Like, For Once in My Life and I Don't Know Why, that's like top five. Like, if you were to say those are top five Stevie songs, I can't knock it. He did them when he was 18.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and those are considered his incubation period?
Yes.
That's considered his training. That's his prep school.
Yes.
That's his JUCO era, right? That's
yes.
JUCO era Stevie, when they're like, yeah, he's still figuring it out. Signed, Sealed, and Delivered is technically in that era.
Yes.
Right?
My Sharia Moore is in that era.
What?
Right. Like, as far as Stevie Wonder albums go, those late Motown ones, you can make an argument of Better Than Life Fulfilling his first finale, which is incredible. But the Signed, Sealed, and Delivered album, okay, this is a 4-song run on that album, okay? Never Had a Dream Come True, The We Can Work It Out cover, Signed, Sealed, Delivered, I'm Yours, Heaven Help Us All. The first 4 songs on the record!
Yeah, his toss-offs are better than people's prime cuts. And when he decides, this is the other thing too, is that Stevie was so talented that he could just be boundlessly generous and insanely cruel at the same time, because he'd just give people songs. He gave people songs all the time. Sometimes he just didn't even push it, like Tears of a Clown.
Tears of a Clown!
Tears of a Clown's just like, I think he wrote that 6 years prior or 5 years prior to Smokey Robinson doing it. And when, like, Smokey kind of needed a career kick and redid it, and it hits like 5 or 6 years later. And like, Stevie probably forgot he wrote that.
Yes.
When it happened, right? And then Smokey's like, hey, I'm going to do that song. Which one? I have like thousands. Oh, that one. Okay, cool. Go. Take it. But when he did a cover, he took it from you, right? Because yes. We Can Work It Out. We Can Work It Out as Stevie's song. Anytime he did a cover, it became instantly better. When he did standards, if you ever heard Stevie just rip off a standard, don't, if you really like another version of it, because it belongs to him now.
Yeah, you know, as Black person, I did not realize We Could Work It Out was a cover, right? Like, and then I got to the Beatles version, which, by the way, is very good. It is a very good song, and I really like it when they slow it down for fussing and fighting, you know, and then they ramp it back mm-hmm. up. Okay, cool. Then you go hear Stevie with that guitar lick to start, that, and you're like, oh no, this is mm-hmm. something completely different here. And by the way, guys, for that is, again, Stevie Wonder at 19 years old, 20 years mm-hmm. old. Like, that's where he is. And so for people who don't know the arc of the Stevie Wonder career, this is where it gets interesting. His contract runs out at Motown. He decides to go to USC to take some music classes, like take some music theory classes. and try to negotiate his deal. And Motown had been breaking people on these deals, awful deals, for the longest. Now, Berry Gordy always makes the argument we were given the same deals as everybody else, right? We took our contracts as a template from MGM or somebody like that. Okay, but they come to Stevie. They're trying to work out the deal. They kind of hardlining it. Stevie's like, hey, guys, I got two albums done right here. Wherever I go, I am taking these two albums. I can go somewhere else or I can stay here. What's it going to be? And Berry Gordy's like, I guess it's going to be here. Because by then, he didn't need the assembly line. He didn't need any of the cats that they had.
Mm-hmm. And there's another thing, too. This is where technology and Stevie Wonder meet. It's incredible to me, by the way, how much of the world this man figured out with his ears. Because one thing tying him to Motown was the technology, i.e., he needed a backup band, right? Stevie was one of the first artists to figure out, those royalties go a lot farther if I don't have to split them with people and if I don't have to expend the money going forward. And one of the ways in which he heard that and figured it out was electronic music coming along, okay? Because in 1971, 72, Stevie starts messing with rooms full of knobs, dials, and plugs, okay? He recruits two guys to do this, right? Two electronic music pioneers. But also consider, for the most part, working with something called Tonto. Does that make it cooler? There's this giant synth thing, computer creature called Tonto that Stevie's just kind of talking to when he's trying to figure out all the keyboards that he's going to use on all of his classic albums. He figures out, hey, man, I can just play it all. Like on the classic track, on Superstition, how much of that is Stevie? Everything but the horn.
Oh, yeah. Because we go get, like, because think about this, right? He gets to Motown with the two albums in the can. One of them is pretty good. One of them is very good. Like where I'm coming from, I see as pretty good. Music of My Mind. And if you saw that Atlanta episode, I think it's the Teddy Harper episode, right? It doesn't start with Superwoman. I can't remember what the song is that plays in the beginning.
I think it's Superwoman because I think it's in.
Okay. Because On the Way Out, it's Evil, right? But both of those, like the binding tie of that is, no, it's Sweet Little Girl. That was the one on the way in with Sweet Little Girl. And then On the Way Out, it's Evil. And like, yo, this is a smoking record. Superwoman for me is the number one Stevie track. That is my, not trying to be cute because people like to try to be cute. Like that is my number one. And then we get to Talking Book where we get to Superstition. And you and I talked about this. My theory has been, well, actually, I'll let you break this down about what is incredible about what is and is not in Superstition.
Okay, so things that are not in Superstition, okay? There's not a bass player. The bass line is played on a synth by Stevie's left hand.
At that point, that Moog that everybody was using, no, it was basically Stevie.
Mm-hmm. No. When you talk about who put that in the mix and who made that something people wanted to use, it's Stevie, okay? It's Tonto. It's working with these like gigantic rooms full of stuff that looks like a Radio Shack, an old Radio Shack threw up, right? That's what he's working with, okay? In the dark, like figure out that he's just sitting there twiddling knobs, right? As a blind man, figuring out what sounds best. And he did it better than anyone else without eyes. That's bonkers, okay? So you won't hear a bass player. What you hear is the bass line played on the left hand. You won't hear any drummer except Stevie, okay? Because Stevie is playing the drums, okay? On a real simple kit too, okay? Because most of the time, not to get super technical here, but there's only three rhythm tracks on this thing. There's only three. Now, most of the time when you're mixing a 16 track studio song in the early 70s, mid 70s, there's, you know, you'll use a few more than that. Nope. Three. That's it. It's like kick, hi-hat, and snare tom. That's it. That's all he's got, okay? You won't hear a guitar on this track. Later on, if you saw, like, I tweeted out a while ago, and a lot of people watched it, the Sesame Street video, which is Stevie playing the whole thing on the set of Sesame Street with his full band, instrumentation, I believe two guitarists on the track, including Ray Parker Jr. of Ghostbusters, who was one of his longtime studio collaborators, right? His studio collaborators are a whole other thing we can talk about. They're fascinating. But you won't hear a guitar on it, okay? The only thing you'll hear are three clavinet tracks. That's it. There are three clavinet tracks. Do you know what he's doing on those clavinet tracks? No one's really sure. Like, there's a riff that's played, and then there are these other two that are just kind of playing notes, okay? And not just playing notes, but getting you to hear things. This is where the music theory classes come in. Stevie, in those music theory classes, learned that your brain will fill in stuff rhythmically, right? So one of the things that he's getting you to do in that song is getting you to count beats that aren't there. That's like when a song jumps or when a song hops, one of the things that makes it work is your brain is filling in beats that aren't necessarily played. They're ghost notes in your head that are going, right? And we were having this discussion, what came first, the drum beat or the riff? Well, the way the song was actually constructed was Jeff Beck, a guitar player of all people who Stevie was working with in the studio, was playing this drum beat. And Stevie goes, hold on a second. Like, that was how this song started. When Stevie goes, huh, keep playing that. And then goes, and put down a demo, which was essentially the gist of the song.
Yeah.
Right there. So did he come up with the riff or the drum track first? Yes, that's the answer, okay? But then he improved the drum track. He improved the drum track and made it better because Stevie also happens to be an amazing drummer. One more thing that you will not hear on this track, right, it, song-wise, by the way, is anything that's out of Doric E-flat. And this is one of the coolest things. We haven't talked about this. One of the coolest things about this track is this, that the riff and the melody, they are variations of the other, okay? A lot of times, like, a chorus might go kind of off on its own, or the verse might kind of go off on its own. Stevie's singing a chorus that goes off of the main riff. Same notes, right? Same scale. And he's just doing a variation on it when he's singing, which shows you how lined up things are in his head. Like, the thing that makes this track work, there's no seams. There's nothing that does not fit in this track.
Yeah.
Okay? And I mean from the root. And it's not like Stevie in his head is sitting there going, oh, yeah, that's E-flat Doric. I'm just going to do the whole thing in that. Nope, just seamless. Just came out like that.
And there's never been a song that sounded like it before. Like, I think that's the hard part. If people who were of that time are like, yo, Superstition is my favorite Stevie song ever, because nothing had sounded like it before. I tried to make that point on Twitter, and people were like, well, what about? And they'd be like, well, others were as good. I'm not talking about as good. I'm talking about there are some songs, like When Doves Cry is a great example of this. There has never been a song that sounded like it before. There has never been a song that sounded like it after. You can say there were some that were as good. Okay, cool. But there's never been a song that sounded like that one. Superstition, like in the context of the album, like Maybe Your Baby is on that record, right? Great song of a similar vein. It does not sound like this. Nothing does. He couldn't even go back to it. Like Prince couldn't even go back to When Doves Cry. This is a one time only, guys. One time only. And you can hear it influence everybody else, but nobody could get it. Like nobody could make a sound alike of Superstition. Because like you said, we don't even exactly know what he was doing.
And here's the other thing too, like, and this has something to do with the key it was written in, but I think it has more to do with the subject matter and the delivery. How many songs in 1972 do you think just sounded evil? Go ahead. Let's just look through 1972 and you go, hey man, what's on the charts? What's making everything feel so good? Okay. American Pie is on the charts in 1972. Okay. The Candyman by Sammy Davis Jr. is on the tracks. Okay. Brandy by Looking Glass is a top 10 song, okay? Even the slower ballads, all right? Let's Stay Together is 1972. Let's Stay Together. My argument, like all-time top 20 American songbook song,
right.
Let's Stay Together by Al Green. Even that's a beautiful, uplifting sounding song, right? Tinged with a little bit of the sadness of love itself, but still there. And yet, if you put on Superstition, the first thing you think is you're like, oh, something really evil's happening here.
Yes.
Kind of spooky, like kind of sinister. Like I'm tapping my foot. But the chorus is, when you believe in things you don't understand, you'll suffer. Good Lord. That song, by the way, like just to keep going through the technical, that is not a first person song. It is not a second person song. It is not a third person song. The lyrics are written in all three.
Yes.
Okay. That's not to say there's a coherent narrative in those lyrics. Okay. And thank God, because like lyrics are deeply overrated, right? Like this song could have been sung with nonsense syllables and it would still knock.
Yes.
All right. Just because of the way it's built. But it's written in all three. That song's coming from everywhere, from every single perspective, narratively, if you're listening to it. It's dark. It's evil. Like I listen to it, and I can't stop listening to it. I've been listening to the song for the better part of, you know, 4 or 5 decades at this point. And every single time, I think, this sounds like a Ouija board. This sounds like its topic, its content.
Think about this, how cold it is that that's 1972, he does Talking Book. Mm-hmm. Which also has You Are the Sunshine of My Life, another just all-time incredible, one of the greatest songs. Right. I believe the first song of the record is You Are the Sunshine of My Life. First song on the second side is Superstition, right? But after that album is when people are like, and you know, that's when Stevie really got going. What? Like, that's when you get to Inner Visions, where Too High starts off, right? She's a girl in a dream, a four-eyed cartoon monster on a TV screen, takes another puff and says it's a crazy scene, and red is green, and she's a tangerine, which is, again, an incredible set of lyrics for a man y'all tell me can't see. That's track one, and it's him on the drums, and he's playing a lot of cymbal because he's a real jazz drummer, right? Like, that's the thing. It's a very simple drumming style. I don't want to say simple. That's not fair, but it's a very straightforward style of drumming with a lot of hard snares and a lot of hard ride cymbal type stuff or whatever it is. And he just runs through that whole album that has Living for the City, which has maybe the greatest skit ever produced. And he produced it in 1973, Technology. And then, like, the I'm pulling it out and putting it on the table track for him, Don't You Worry About a Thing, where he just, ooh, talking smack to some girl, right? Hit him with all his rap.
Speaking Spanish.
Yes.
Playing a diabolically difficult, like, Latin-influenced piano riff the whole time. By the way, not only does this, starts off by speaking something that people sort of assume was gibberish. It's not. All right. No. Todo está bien, shaved, right? That's totally a thing. But also sings it back to her on the ride out, right? And kind of talks a mess to her mid-song about, like, what she's expecting in life, right? Yes. Like, it is the most arrogant Stevie Wonder track. It's beautiful.
Well, especially considering the fact that he basically plays everything but the shaker and bongos. Like, everything that's on there, he is playing. And by the way, this is the album that he was working on when he was in a car accident where a tree fell on his car and was in a coma, and Higher Ground is so dope that it woke him up out the coma.
Mm-hmm.
He's in a coma, somebody plays Higher Ground, and he starts tapping his fingers.
And also that he really believed that he was kind of on a mission from God at that point.
Yes.
Most of us get hit by a car and we wake up and we're like, this hurts. I think I'm going to take it easy for a while. Stevie Wonder woke up, lost his sense of smell in the accident, by the way, just in case things weren't hard enough already, and then says, you know what? I'm going to make a double album.
Yeah, let's think, right? He goes and does Fulfilled in the first finale, which is very good. And then the year after that was the year that Paul Simon won the Grammy for Best Album and said, because Stevie had won it the 2 years before, and thanks Stevie Wonder for not putting out an album that year so that he could win Best Album. And of course, Stevie Wonder then puts out Songs in the Key of Life and wins Best Album for that, and the first disc in particular. So this thing has Sir Duke, I Wish, and Knocks Me Off My Feet back to back to back.
Mm-hmm. If you're a fan of Gangster's Paradise, it's got Pastime Paradise.
And that's the next one.
Which Stevie let Coolio use as long as Coolio wouldn't cuss on it. That was Stevie's thing, was, yeah, you can use it as long as you don't cuss. Which, if you're Coolio asking for anything from Stevie Wonder, your answer is, thank you, and I will not. Yeah, yes. I'm not going to. Then, by the way, like, sides 3 and 4, once you get into that, I do think there's a little bit of, like, you might, something skippable. It starts with, Isn't She Lovely?
Yes, it does.
It has, by the way, on, like, side 4, which is usually where I think you would put the midnight snacks. You would put the forgettables that you would only consume when you were really in need of a late night snack. That's where he puts As, which is my favorite Stevie Wonder song ever. That's the one where I'm convinced, like, that's the beginning of the end for Stevie, because I'm convinced he met God and God was like, you're doing too much.
The thing about As is, it is not a great mix. Like, that is the one thing I will say. It is one that I wish that in studio they would, like, tighten up just a little bit. Mm-hmm. But it's, like, lyrical genius, instrumental genius. And then it gets to the end when Stevie starts hollering at you, right? You know it means something when Stevie starts to scream at you. And so he does it and runs through it. And then comes after that with, like, another star.
Heater.
Right. That's another heater. I went to see Stevie. Because have you seen him live?
No.
Okay. Because we have so much more Stevie that we could get to, and it's going to be hard for us because we have time constraints, right? Because even after Songs in the Key of Life, you get to Hotter Than July, which is actually a smoker. That's the rap on, like, the super greatness of Stevie. You get, like, moments after that, right? But, like, Hotter Than July is, like, the end on it. But I seen Stevie live twice. And the first time I saw him live was on that Songs in the Key of Life tour that he went on a few years ago. And I saw him at Phillips Arena in Atlanta, right? And it's always interesting because you're there with a lot of people who know they should be seeing Stevie Wonder, but you can obviously tell that they aren't really big fans, because when he does Loves in Need of Love Today and Have a Talk with God and Vintage Ghetto Land, they're looking like, I don't really know what's going on. And then they hear Sir Duke, and now I'm looking on the floor, and Ernie Johnson and everybody else is now on their feet, right? Because, song I know, right?
Yeah.
My brother had seen Stevie, and he told me, he said, there is zero degradation in the quality of his voice over the years. That was what he said. And I was like, okay, well, let's see. Because, you know, you think of Stevie as a good singer, as a capable singer, but not as a great singer. I go see Stevie. Stevie is the best live singer I have ever seen. Like, he has the most powerful voice I've ever seen. And then he's in there and he's going, he's playing all the instruments, right? Like, he's playing the harmonica. But where he flips up the game on you is he plays that lap guitar, right? After he goes through every track on Songs in the Key of Life, he eventually goes and then plays, like, some other songs, right? He's got Indy Irie as his backup singer, which, you know, probably best. Sure. You know, he's got her there. the band is just monstrous, but every song, it is screaming out of the speakers when he sings. And it's just like, on top of all this, you are actually one of the best singers who ever lived.
Everyone at Motown, that was their main point when asked about Stevie for a retrospective, was you do not understand what a good singer he is or how powerful a singer he is. Because I think if you record him, he can come across as a little thin and tinny just because he's usually singing away from the mic and he's usually backing off from the instrumentation. But when he wants to blow, he can knock out a mic. If you go to the Saturday Night Live with Eddie Murphy, where Eddie Murphy is kind of making fun of Stevie Wonder, and he sings My Sharia Moore right next to Stevie Wonder, which there's a moment for Eddie Murphy in life where you're like, I'm going to sing My Sharia Moore,
yes,
standing next to the guy who sang My Sharia Moore, okay, when he was 18. And Stevie goes, no, that's not it. That's not it. Hold on, let me do it. And he sings it, and he blows out the mic. He blows out a TV mic, a boom mic that's like over his head, singing My Sharia Moore. The sheer volume with which he can sustain the exact same top quality voice is nuts, technically.
Hearing him sing If It's Magic, right? Because mm-hmm. that is the most sparse song on Songs in the Key of Life when he goes through it. It's basically just the harp, right? Like, it's just him and a harp.
Mm-hmm.
And he just kills it, man. Like, the second mm-hmm. time I saw him live was a little disappointing. I saw him at Red Rocks. He was not well. Like, it was obvious that he was sick. His voice wasn't all the way there. And this is what was funny. So Usher happened to be there, because I guess Usher did the same thing I did. It was like, yo, Stevie's playing Red Rocks, I'll be there, right?
Yeah.
So, Jimmy, just imagine being me. And, you know, the way to put it is, when I'm in Vegas, I gamble. You know what I'm saying? Red Rocks is in Colorado. So it's Stevie. You're in the mountains. You've got this incredible view, right? Like, the place is packed, all of this stuff. And Usher had come. And somebody got Usher to come on stage, right? But Usher had this thing where Janelle Monáe had the same problem at the Atlanta show, where they ain't really know all the words, right? Like, mm-hmm. it's actually a lot to ask somebody to know the words that he saws on command. Yeah. And so Stevie is doing Ribbon in the Sky, and he's feeding Usher the lines, but Usher can't quite get the lines, right? So Stevie's like, for so long, and then Usher's supposed to go, for so long, on this night I pray, right? And mm-hmm. at some point, you could tell Stevie was clearly getting frustrated with Usher not getting this right.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, it reached a point where Usher started dancing on the piano because Usher was just like, what do I do to keep this going? But at one point, Usher looked at Stevie and said, you talk too fast. Because he just couldn't get it. And Usher, who can sing his ass off himself, it was still like, man, you're still not quite Stevie. Like, it's not your fault, but you're still not quite Stevie.
No, for a lung test, this is what you should do in your car. And by the way, Stevie, you will fail car karaoke with Stevie every time, because when you have the music up and you're singing along, you go, hey, you know what? I can sing this. It's pretty good. Turn it down for a second. You can't. Stevie's just a backing track so powerful he makes you sound good. Go and listen to Overjoyed and then try to sing along with it and hold a note. By like the third line, you were going to be out of breath. He can hold a note so long at such heights that you don't even really realize how hard it is until you try to do it, even with your horrible dog bark voice, right? Try it. He is an astonishing technical singer. Every instrument, like, I mean, if you told me he was the best guitarist of his generation, I would believe you, sight unseen.
Yeah, that video of him as a teenager, and they walk him over to the drums, and they just put the drumsticks in his hand. The two, like, incredible drummers that are, like, the shocks to the world. The number one is Karen Carpenter, right? Like, who may have been the best drummer in the world at a point, but why would you think that? Because it was Karen Carpenter. And then there's Stevie. He's like, oh, okay. And he looks like he's not trying, right? Like, there are very few drummers who do those wild solos and don't look like they're trying. It's very hard to do that and not look like you're trying. Mm-hmm. Stevie just...
No, it's absolutely effortless. Like, Stevie probably thrashes on mandolin, and I don't even know it, right? Like, he's probably the best bluegrass player of his generation, and he just keeps it, like, on the low. It's just a hobby.
Did I tell you what was actually the biggest flex of the Stevie at Red Rock show?
No.
And I think maybe also Songs in the Key of Life, but I know definitely for the Red Rock show, the man didn't sell merch. There was no merchandise for sale. All that easy money, right? All that free money. Press up some shirts. I would have bought 8 of them, right? No merch for sale.
Just keep it.
Yeah, I don't need that. I just came to play some music, baby. I love Colorado. That's it. No opening act, no merch.
That's ridiculous. Oh my God. That's just dropping like a, like just turning down over $100,000 a show. Just, you know, keep it, pores. Stevie doesn't need it.
No. Like, it's everything. There's nobody that's got, like, even Prince. It's a different thing with Prince because there's a bit more of a hit or miss quotient with Prince's stuff. You know, like, I guess it's in part because it's a different sort of ambition that was there. But in Prince, did I grow up on an assembly line? Like, that was the thing about Stevie, was the pop sensibilities of Stevie's music is always there. And it can also, like, it kind of like make it murky how creative it actually is, because it is always so perfect in those ways. Like, he's not breaking a lot of rules. He's just all over the place within the rules that he's following.
He does things that are craft innovative a lot, which means that there is a format, and the thing that he's done to put his own twist on it is brilliant and super innovative, but it's still not going over 3.5 minutes. Yeah. And right, it might be like a music theory thing. He might take a scale and invert it. He might do what I said in Superstition, where he's, you know, singing a melody that's a variation of the riff, right? He might do that. It's not going to be like Prince, where he's like, hey, listen, I'm just going to drop the bass. I'm just, yeah. Right? Like on When Doves Cry, that's the thing, is what? I'm going to start a pop song with this, a Fairlight. Yeah. I'm going to start it with a Fairlight, and I'm going to start it with me doing weird noises in the back and a tiny little synthesizer, right? And Stevie could get close to that, right? But it wouldn't be as stark, right? So, like, Prince's departures are further out of field than Stevie's a lot of the time, but not much further, right? Like, they're both getting to the same point from different perspectives.
Yeah, he's almost kind of like a James Brown in a sense, although James Brown would do stuff like that, but they'd be like, yo, so what's the meter on that song? There isn't one. The meter, like George Benson would talk about that with James. Like, you try to figure out what the meter is on that song? No, it doesn't exist, right? James would be like, okay, you know, we're just going to do this, right? Because James is not trained in the same way that Stevie is. Like, he's not going off the board like that. And by the way, when Stevie does decide we're going to do a 7-minute song, it's going to be Superwoman. It's going to be ass, right? Like, it's going to be a monster.
A suite. And it's going to be composed, right? Like, if as goes super long, the thing that makes as so interesting to me, okay, and this is super music geek, but the thing that makes as so interesting to me is that it does not vary. It's not a suite. There's other, like, Stevie songs where there's movements and things change, right? Or there's tempo changes. As is a loop. As is actually, as close as he'll get to, like, a long gospel number or some kind of rag where it's just the same thing over and over again, but intensifying. And the only thing making it more or less intense, by the way, is the voice. That's it. It is the most voice-oriented Stevie track, because the only thing really raising the like volume on that and the intensity is him getting louder and louder and louder and louder, and voices in the back. By the way, another casual flex. You know who one of the background singers on As is? You ever looked it up? Michael Jackson. He's back there. Think about that, right? Like, how in awe were people of him from the age of 11? He went to Michael Jackson. It's like, hey, could you just drop some vocals on this little track?
You know who sang background on Part-Time Lover?
Who?
Luther. now keep in mind that Luther was a legendary session singer, but he's famous by now, right? He's like, yeah, I'll go sing behind Stevie Wonder. Of course, they have to pay me.
This is one of my favorite flexes of all time, by the way, is when you get somebody on background singing, you go, hey, that person sounds real famous. And you look it up and you're like, that person is real famous. Like Frank Ocean, Pink and White. Great track. You know who's just sort of hanging in the background back there? Beyonce. He used Beyonce as a background singer. Beyonce was like, cool. What a flex.
That's an incredible flex for Frank Ocean, because, like, he's Frank Ocean, but he ain't Stevie Wonder, right?
No,
like,
Stevie, no.
Like, I'm trying to think who the person that would be like, Stevie's like, I was just wondering if you would sing back up. We don't really have a budget. Who's the person that's like, I don't work for free, Steve, because it ain't me.
No, I can't think of a single person. Oh, by the way, also on As, Herbie Hancock. Just Herbie Hancock playing. Like, Herbie Hancock's already musician famous at that point. He's just bumping along there. Stevie, by the way, will return this favor. Again, going back to, he's an incredibly generous musician. Incredibly. Just, he will pop up on all kinds of unexpected spots. Stevie pops up, of all places, he pops up as the harmonica on I Feel For You by Chaka Khan.
Yes, he does.
Right? Not necessary. That song can go without the harmonica, but it's way cooler if Stevie's on it.
Oh, man, I hate we're running out of time, because the thing with Stevie on harmonica, so, like, he's not like your man John Popper from Blues Traveler, right, who can play the chromatic scale and do all these crazy... Stevie just blows in, and it's like, nobody sounds like this. Like, why is this sound so strong?
How do you take something like a harmonica? And I know it's you. every time that man, like, I think he could actually play, like, that guy could play a rubber band and I would know it was him.
Yeah. Like, if I was Bob Dylan, who likes to indulge in a little harmonica here and there, or Neil Young, who likes to indulge in a little harmonica here and there, after you hear Stevie play the harmonica, how do you not just throw your shit out? Like, what am I even doing here?
No, I think you just have the ultimate humility there. Like, Neil Young or Bob Dylan, and you're playing next to Stevie Wonder, you just go, I'm lucky to be here. I don't really know how I got here, but I'm just going to keep doing my thing because it got me here. Even if it sounds like trash compared to that man, you know, like an example of his brilliance. And again, of people popping up, I Ain't Gonna Stand For It on Hotter Than July.
Yes, the country song.
When Stevie just decides to do a country song and knocks out a country banger, right? You know who's on background there? The Gap Band. I love that he got on board with the country song and was like, yeah, no, this country song absolutely rocks. Who am I going to bring along? Tulsa's Finest. And those guys were like, in.
Why am I going to bring them? Because they play it on a Leon Russell album, right? Mm-hmm. They're like, oh, yeah, they've done stuff like this before.
Oh, they grew up in Oklahoma. They got this there. This is done. They've got this down. By the way, just in case you think it's too country, you get to the chorus and there's a funk bass line under it. Just because Stevie's like, I can only do so much of this before, right, I get a little bit in.
And again, this is the album, Hotter Than July, that's like the end of the classic period or the beginning of the post-classic period. Let's talk about what's on there right fast, mm-hmm. Okay? As If You Read My Mind, which he still plays in concert. He played that at Red Rocks.
Yeah.
Master Blaster.
Yeah.
All I Do.
Yeah.
I Ain't Gonna Stand For It. And Rocket Love.
Yeah. All-time Stevie Wonder love song, right? Stevie Wonder, by the way, cranks out like some of his best love songs in that post-classic period. He writes The Wedding Song, right? Like,
yes.
Kwame Brown's yes. favorite, Ribbon in the Sky, right? Where every time I hear it, I'm like, I should go back to 1983 and get married in a blue suit with the ruffles, right? And a little like bow tie, like just makes you want to get married. Even if you don't like, even if you're not dating anybody, you're like, I should go get married when I listen to this song. He writes that post. That's just like a toss off. He writes Overjoyed, right? Which, by the way, the marriage of Overjoyed in sports marketing with the Jordan brand. I don't know if you remember this ad, like when the Jordan brand came out, they used Overjoyed. And to me, that was like the most plush old man ad I have ever seen in my life. Like, I was like, oh, perfectly targeted, man.
Yeah, no, we actually might have to resume this at another point because they didn't even get into nobody writes what I call easy breezy love songs better than Stevie. Like, for me, it's Stevie and Bob Marley, like very simple, straight to the point love songs. It's not like, it's not way over the top. It's not crazy turns of phrase. It's, you know, I feel like this is the beginning, though I've known you for a million years. That's it. That's all you need.
Yeah, or this too, that I could be sincere and it's not overwrought and that we're going to get there in 3 minutes. Like, I'm going to get you through two verses and a couple choruses in 2 minutes. It's going to be super straightforward and it's going to be the prettiest thing you've ever heard. And then I'm out. And by the way, like, I don't know if you've been in love until you hear a Stevie Wonder song. That may sound overblown, but then you listen to a Stevie Wonder ballad and you're like, oh, that's what it's like.
Yeah, Knocks Me Off My Feet is the one where I'm like, oh, that's what you mean.
Yeah, no. I get it now. The thing that blows me, like, all right, there are 9,000 things that blow me away about Stevie Wonder, but his ability to create a song for every situation, because I don't know anybody who can be as cynical as he is and as absolutely sincere and joyous and full of hope as he is. I am not a religious person, okay? I'm a very cynical person. So when I hear He's Mr. Know-It-All, I'm like, yeah, that song's about Nixon. That's completely accurate. That's about, and it's not just about Nixon, though. Didn't seat himself in a particular time and limit him to that. That song is about any kind of extremely deceptive, cynical leader.
And then he did it again with You Haven't Done Nothing, which, by the way, Jackson 5, sing it back up.
Just casual. Just here, bring in the Jackson 5. Yeah, we'll sing the song about, like, you know, the evil of humanity. Superstition. Superstition's about, like, the uncertainty of life on this planet. And it is not a particularly hopeful song, right? It is just reflective of a feeling of deep uncertainty, doubt, and a little bit of evil creeping in there, right?
Well, yeah, from Inner Visions, Fulfilling the First Finale, and side one of Songs in the Key of Life. Not really happy.
No.
You really think about it. Love's in Need of Love Today, to Have a Talk with God, to Village Ghetto Land. Yo, that's a bummer. That's bummer after bummer after bummer. He eventually gets his hopes up.
No, but like, these are very cynical songs and they work because they knock, right? Like, you can tell me all the bad news in the world, but if it goes and it comes around to the one every time, I am going to buy it all. But he can do that. And then he can write Isn't She Lovely, which, like, if Isn't She Lovely doesn't just sort of hit you as, like, I think before you have kids, you hear Isn't She Lovely and you go, ah, oh, that's cute. He wrote a song about his daughter. You have kids and you hear Isn't She Lovely and you go, that's exactly what it's like, Stevie. That's exactly what it's like.
By the way, I think Aisha sings backup for him and she is lovely indeed. Just in case you were curious.
The man has never told a lie. Man has never told a single lie. Keep in mind, too, all of this, and he wrote the best grandma song ever, right? I Just Called to Say I Love You. The song that, like, in the 80s,
song so much.
It is, I hate it too, but that is the best grandma song ever, yeah. Right?
And by the way, it is by far his biggest hit, and when he played that at Rare Rocks, man, white folks love that, man. White folks could not get enough, and I was like, I guess I should have known this was coming.
Remember, just in closing here, I know we're up against time here, but remember, the things you love are not the things other people love. And the things you think are the biggest songs, right? They're going to disappoint you. So you better be ready for it, right? Yes, like, for instance, in karaoke, if I want to get the white delegation on board, I want to sing four or five different songs that I love deep in my heart, right? I would love to sing Freebird. You know how many people are going to get on board when you sing Freebird? Not everybody. I know what's going to get the white delegation hopping. I know what's going to get the Northeast on my side. I know what's going to get the coast on my side. I know what's going to get the Midwest on my side. And it is a song I despise in my bones, from my marrow out to my flesh. Okay. And it is Sweet Caroline. If I sing Sweet Caroline, there is something in the Caucasoid DNA that immediately lights up the minute they hear Neil Diamond. I can't do a thing about it. It just works.
Yeah. It's also on Sweet Caroline, it is an interracial wedding favorite because it is very popular among those white people and the black people who hang out with those particular white people, to the point where their friend would marry that particular white woman. Mm-hmm. And therefore, this is the song that is going to be played. Wow. This is how we wrap this up. That was fun. Spencer Hall, check him out. Banner Society, Thinking Out Loud with the SEC Network.
Thinking Out Loud, the Shutdown Fullcast, probably my primary vehicle right now, along with Twitter account at EDSBS. Follow me. I'll apologize in advance, but, you know, after that, you'll enjoy it. Just the first couple of tweets, probably a little off-putting. But yeah, this was a blast. I can talk about Stevie Wonder for another 9 hours.
We actually might do this again just because.
That's fine.
Right. I'm down. And ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this thing a couple times a week. Tony Collada, you and Gabe Bassain handle everything behind the scenes. Thank you, gentlemen. Remember, follow The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. If you give us 4 stars, I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. And we'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or follow on the ESPN app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.